Welcome to Novelist Spotlight, the podcast where published fiction writers are interviewed to gather their insights and writing lessons so we can use them to make ourselves better and more effective writers. There are just three things I ask of you, if appropriate to you and your experience. Please subscribe, please click on the like button, and please share this program link with any family members, friends, or colleagues who might be interested or benefit from the content. Now, on with our program.
Hello, my name is Elena Gorokova. I grew up in Leningrad, Russia. Now it is St. Petersburg. It's back to its original name. And at the age of 10, I started learning English. In fact, I was seduced by the beauty of the English language. And to my mother's bewilderment, I spent the next decade deciphering the secrets of English. I went to a special English school. And then I graduated from the English department of Leningrad University. My mother was a physician and then a professor of anatomy at the time when I was growing up. And she didn't want me to learn English. She wanted me to be a doctor like she was. She wanted me to go to medical school. And I sort of defied her, just as my sister did when my older sister became an actress. I became an English major, and English was really mesmerizing. It sounded mysterious and beautiful. I guess it was the beauty of the unknown. The intonation soared at the end of sentences, unlike in Russian. There was an openness about English. There was mystery. There was hope. And I spent my life in Russia learning the language. And when I was 24, I moved to the United States. I got married to an American citizen. That was, for me, the only way to leave the country, because at the time, it was a totalitarian regime. We lived behind the Iron Curtain. And I came to this country when I was 24, carrying one suitcase with 20 kilograms of what used to be my life. I'm very sorry to say that the country I left is back to being a totalitarian country right now. My friends in Ukraine are sitting in bomb shelters in Kiev. My friends in Russia have been taken hostage to the imperial paranoia, and they are afraid to speak because they will be denounced, just as people were denounced for thinking differently during Stalin times. So they're back to the same totalitarian regime as is the setting of this novel, A Train to Moscow.
And this is Mike Consul, your host. And as you can hear, Elena has a very interesting and rich story. And she tells it in great detail in two different memoirs that she's written. One's called A Mountain of Crumbs, and the other is called Russian Tattoo. Those names are in the episode notes below. But most recently, she has written a novel, her first novel. It's called A Train to Moscow, that she just mentioned. And Elena, I want to welcome you to the program, and I want you to know that the American people support your Ukrainian friends and family, your Russian friends and family. I know it's such a difficult time out there. It's absolutely heart-wrenching to be watching the news these days, and I've been pretty much obsessed with it and paying attention to what's going on there. And it's a beautiful story you've got there, coming to America and wanting to write and wanting to use the English language to tell your story. Tell us about A Train to Moscow. You were just indicating that the story is about the totalitarian regime.
Well, the novel, A Train to Moscow, is set during and after World War II. And those were Stalin's times. Those were the times of fear of Stalin's purges and Gulag labor camps. My mother's uncle was arrested for telling a joke, an innocuous joke. He was sent to a labor camp and he never returned. And everyone knew of someone executed or sent to the northern fringes of the country. And my family was no exception to that, unfortunately. So the times, those times were severe times of purges and the Gulag. The Iron Curtain has come down, has descended. That there is no question about that. The freedoms have been taken away. There are repressions. People can get arrested according to the new law. People can get arrested in Russia and imprisoned for 15 years just for calling this war a war. The Putin's narrative is that this is a special military operation that is being undertaken to, that's quoting, denazify Ukraine. And if anyone calls it a war for what it is, if anyone mentions the bombardment of civilians, as we know that is happening, people can be arrested and imprisoned for 15 years. So if this is not a return to Stalin's purges and to the totalitarian regime, I don't know what is. And more than that, my friends are saying that they're afraid of those who support this war in Russia and who can denounce them the same way people were denounced during Stalin's times. And this is what is really, it gives me such pause, and it is so chilling to know this, that there are some people that are, according to my friend, it's 30 to 40% of Russians in Russia who support Putin in this war and who not only support Putin, but denounce others who don't.
It's one of those situations that we thought we were past. I mean, the world has moved forward. There's so much transparency these days. And yet, despite the transparency, what we see, Elena, is that people will still be bamboozled. They'll still be given false information. They'll still believe false information and so on. It's really a horrible situation. It's a situation you escaped and you told your story. Let me ask you this about, let's go back to your memoirs to start, because that's where your writing career really began as far as your public writing career. On the one hand, there are people who would think it's easy to tell your own story, but oftentimes it's very hard to tell your own story because it is your story and it's very personal. Did you find it difficult to tell the story, or was it very easy for you? Did it flow, or was it one of those things that were highly emotional for you?
The first memoir, A Mountain of Crumbs, took many years to write. When I moved to this country, I thought I spoke English. I learned English all my life in Russia. But of course, the English that I learned was, well, first of all, it was British English. So the vocabulary and the pronunciation were completely different. But the major difference was in the culture, of course. And because I arrived in this country from behind the Iron Curtain, literally, I had no information about, we did not know anything about the West. So it took me a while. I was in culture shock for several years. It took me a while to understand where I am and how people interact in this culture. And it certainly took me years to learn how to write, just write in English. It's just a different way of writing. You know, every language has its own rules, and Russian has different rules than English. So I learned how to write in English. That was one, you know, one thing.
Did you ever think about, let me just interrupt you for a second, because sure. What immediately popped to mind is, do you ever think in terms of writing in Russian and then having an English translator turn it into proper English?
No,
did that cross your mind?
No, never did. It's interesting. It's a very valid question. But it never occurred to me that I would write in English. In Russian. And maybe it is because I tried to immerse myself into English. And this was my way of learning it, of learning English, American English, and the American culture. And that was the only way I thought I could really understand it. So for a while, I tried to separate the languages, and it was almost like I was operating with a different brain. There was a Russian brain and there was an English brain, and they didn't cross. One did not cross over to the other. They did not connect in any way. And I don't know if it was right or wrong, but that's how I did it. So it took a while for me to learn how to write in English. But then there was also the question of being, it was almost like being allowed to write. I couldn't imagine that anyone would be interested in this story, a story of growing up in Soviet Russia. I didn't take myself seriously until I signed up for a workshop that was taught by Frank McCourt, the author of Angela's Ashes. Mm-hmm. And I was very fortunate to have studied with him. And he was, you know who Frank McCourt was. I don't have to explain to you how wonderful and funny he was. And he was as funny and as approachable in person as he was on the page. And he almost gave me permission to write. He encouraged me. He made some very encouraging comments on my submission, on my chapters that I submitted to be part of that workshop. And after that workshop, something happened that it was almost like a watershed for me. I sent out a few stories that became chapters of the first memoir to literary magazines, and they were all published in a matter of maybe 1 or 2 years. So that's when it started. That's when I got this permission in quotation marks to write. And then from that point on, it coalesced into a memoir. It coalesced into, maybe the tone changed because I learned humor from Frank McCourt. I learned irony from him. And that's when this first memoir began to come together.
And if anybody doesn't remember Frank McCourt, Angela's Ashes won the Pulitzer Prize back in the day. And he was on 60 Minutes. He became very, very famous. It's been a while since he broke out. But yes, Angela's Ashes was his story of growing up in Ireland, poor in Ireland, and so on. Now, you wrote a second memoir. Why two memoirs? I mean, talk about the scope of the first one versus the scope of the second one. What did you have to say in the second one that you didn't have to say in the first one?
The first one is about growing up in Soviet Russia, and it ends on the protagonist leaving for the United States. And I thought that was it. That was it with memoirs. I didn't have to say anything else. But after the publication of the first memoir, I received a number of emails from readers who wanted to know what happened to this protagonist, who were asking me to continue to write the journey of what happened to this person in the United States. And I wasn't planning to do that, but the readers sort of encouraged me to do that. And I started writing it. And it became the examination of the culture shock that I mentioned earlier, trying to understand this country, trying to find a new place for myself in a completely unknown culture. And this was a process of very often of humiliation because I made mistakes like all immigrants. I made some mistakes that were funny. And now when I look back, they sound very funny, but they weren't at the time. And one of them, it was the choice, the availability, the abundance of choice in this country in any area of life. Starting from, concrete choices in supermarkets and department stores of what you buy, and to the choice of your choices in life of what you choose for yourself to be and become. We did not have this choice in Soviet Russia. There was no choice in anything. And that was interesting for me to examine the process of getting used to living in this country, getting used to choice, and carving a space for myself in this completely new terrain. So that's what the second memoir did for me, Russian Tattoo. And it's limited to my life in the United States. It starts when I arrive in this country, and it ends with my mother's death. My mother lived with me. She came to this country when my daughter was born, and she lived with me for the last 25 years of her life. And that was another aspect that was interesting for me to examine, the relationship, the way the relationship changed between my mother and me.
And then comes your novel, A Train to Moscow. So the setting is post-World War II. There's a girl who's has a tragic past. She's looking to reconcile that with hope for the future. She's got family secrets. There's loss. There's perseverance and ambition. Small provincial town she lives in behind the Iron Curtain. Her name is Sasha. She lives in, again, a house of secrets. I'm kind of just reading from the notes on the novel. And when she leaves for Moscow to audition for drama school, she defies her mother and grandparents. Now, this does sound like auto fiction. It sounds almost like you're writing about your sister, who's an actress, became an actress. And it sounds like auto fiction, which is very popular these days. So did you find yourself falling into, and I don't say falling into in a negative sense or pejorative sense at all, just feeling that telling your own story is your channel? And you wrote a novel that obviously you're fictionalizing a lot of it, but at the same time, you still feel a sense of ownership about the story because it is your life and your family's life and life behind the Iron Curtain at the time. Is that the case, or do you consider this a complete departure from memoir, and it is truly just, it's a straight fiction novel?
No.
If there even is such a thing.
Yes,
as a straight fiction novel. We all put ourselves in our writing.
Yes, of course, of course. No, you're absolutely right. It family history was my inspiration for this novel. And you're absolutely right that the story of Sasha is based on the story of my sister, who was born in Ivanovo, which is a provincial town, and who wanted to become an actress, who defied her family, went to Moscow, auditioned for the best drama school in the country, got accepted, and became a prominent actress who worked in Leningrad in a repertory theater. It's all based on her. The things that happened in the novel did not happen to my sister. She did not have this communist party apparatchik as her love, the love of her life. But she told me, my sister was instrumental in me writing this novel, because she told me about growing up in Ivanovo. She gave me the details. I visited Ivanovo when I was living in Russia, but I certainly did not have the details of what it was like post-World War II. And she also gave me the details about acting, about becoming someone else. And this is a process that really fascinated me. And it fascinated me in Russia, and it still fascinates me in the United States. I grew up in the wings, backstage of her repertory theater. And in Russia, the theaters are repertory theaters, so they have a permanent cast of actors who work there and who are on a salary from that theater and who participate in different performances that are staged in that theater. And the theater where my sister worked was one of the best theaters in Leningrad. And I spent a lot of time just hanging out in her dressing room and behind the scenes. And it was just fascinating for me, as you can imagine. You know, I was a teenager. I was a child and then a teenager. And she was an older sister. She's 13 years older than I am and was. So I looked up to her, of course, and I wanted to become an actress as well. But I knew it. Even then, I knew I couldn't. So it is based on my sister's theater, but the plot is all made up. The characters are the characters of my family. The mother character is based on my mother, although my mother was not as severe as Sasha's mother. The grandparents are based on my grandparents. So a lot of it is autobiographical, you may say, but the plot is not. On the other hand, as you mentioned, we use our life to write, and that is normal. There's this famous quote from J.M. Coetzee, who said, "All writing is autobiography." J.M. Coetzee is the author of Disgrace and a Nobel Prize winner for literature. All writing is autobiography, and I think he's absolutely right.
I think a lot of people would agree. Yeah, there's just so much of our own experience that obviously goes into the writing of any book. Which of those three books was the most difficult for you to write? One of the memoirs, or was it the novel that was hardest to write?
It was the novel. I would say it was the novel. And the reason may be that I had never written fiction before. And writing a memoir is very different from writing a novel. Just, you know, obviously in the novel you make things up, and in a memoir you don't. Even in a memoir, of course, I had to invent dialogue, for example. The gist where the scene really happened and the characters were real characters. But of course, what people said exactly, you would have to invent that, because we don't remember exactly what we said when we were 10 years old, for example. But that was the only, I would say that was the only invention in a memoir. In a novel, you have to plot. The plot is not there. And that was very difficult for me. I hope I learned how to do it a little better, but it took some time. In fact, the first draft that I submitted to my agent, and of course it was not the first draft for me, it was probably draft number 27, but for my agent it was the first draft. When she looked at it, she said, "This is not a novel, it's a memoir." Mm. And I had to take it back and plot better and change things and introduce certain, you know, other scenes. And
did you write in first person in the first? I'm sorry, Elena, interrupting you, but I'm curious, were you writing in first person during those early drafts? And then, because I know the novelist third person has written in third person.
Right.
Was it first person originally?
It was. And maybe that was a mistake at the time, because it placed me too close to the protagonist, to the narrator. And that's why maybe it sounded like a memoir.
Yeah.
And then when I took it back for revisions, and I had to replot it, so to speak, I changed it to the third person, and I think it helped me to sort of make it a novel, more of a novel, less of a
memoir. Was it freeing in any way, or did you feel more distant from the story because you were writing in third person, or did you feel like it freed you up a little more? And did it also make you omniscient, kind of more of a godlike figure, because you could then access people's interior thoughts and motivations and so on?
Mm-hmm. Well, I wish it were more omniscient. It's not omniscient. It's really close third person, because the main chunk of the narration is done by the narrator, but by the protagonist, by Sasha. It is only at the end where it deviates a little bit into what happened to her lover, and it goes a little bit into his head. And I was struggling with that exact, what you just mentioned, the omniscience of it, or the lack of omniscience, because I wanted to go into other people's heads, and you can't do that when you have a close third person just from the narrator, told by the narrator, the story told by the narrator alone. So there are a lot of things, there are some tricks that you can do. Of course, you know, we all know that but basically it's what she knew, what she saw, what she experienced, or what she heard. So that was a little difficult, and I would like to deviate from that in the next novel, if I am working on another novel, And I would like to deviate from that close third and go more into the omniscient narration.
Interesting. So I'm going to hear about your next one. But first, why don't you read an excerpt from A Train to Moscow? I would just, while you're getting to that page, I'll just tell the listeners that the first couple sentences of the novel is she immediately knows something is wrong. The door to Marek's house is ajar, and there is a black car blocking the street just a few meters away. Not really a car. There aren't many cars in Ivanovo. It looks more like the wagon that plucks drunks off the sidewalks on holidays and deposits them at the sobering station in the town center. That's just the first paragraph there, but the opening sentence is a little bit of a sense of foreboding there when she knows something's immediately wrong. There's a door that's ajar and so on. What part are you going to read from, Elena?
Yes, I'm going to stay with her childhood. But the first, I just want to comment on the first chapter. It is the scene of an arrest. And this is I wanted to start with introducing the Stalin's regime with what it was. It was constant fear. It was a black car pulling up to a house in the middle of the night or in early morning. And there were always two or three NKVD, and that was the precursor to KGB, officers in black trench coats who would barge into a house, turn everything upside down, confiscate the papers that they thought would give them some evidence of wrongdoing, and arrest one of the people who lived in that house. And that the scene of arrests like that were happening all over Soviet Russia. And that's why I wanted to start with it. The scene that I would like to read, Sasha is a young girl, and her mother takes her to Moscow to see the May Day parade. It was May 1st, was and still is a holiday in Russia, and it is International Workers' Day. The mother takes Sasha to this parade as a big celebration, and for Sasha, it was getting to Moscow, seeing Moscow for the first time, participating in this parade. It was a holiday. It was a happy occasion. It takes place in 1950, so Stalin is still alive. Everyone starts walking. People with banners and portraits and red carnations made from construction paper swaying on wire stems. Her mother hoists her up onto her shoulders. So now Sasha is above the people's heads, in the midst of a forest of swaying sticks with flags, banners, and portraits. She peers to her left, where everyone else is peering. There, five columns of people away, a group of men stands on a granite platform against the Kremlin wall. In the center is a separate dark figure in what looks like a military uniform. She knows it is Stalin, their conscience and their revolutionary glory, as the radio reminds them every morning. He is the father to all of them, marching in this square and gathered around radios from here to Kamchatka. Only he's so far away, she can barely see him. He looks tiny and ant-like, and there is nothing glorious about him. Riding on her mother's shoulders, Sasha tries to lean forward to see him better through the forest of portraits and flags, but all she feels is disappointment. He looks nothing like the father they all know, grand and loving and immortalized in oil. Then the ant raises his hand and the square explodes. Every mouth in every lane of every column splits open in one unified roar, and the forest of banners and portraits jolts and sways as if struck by a blast of wind. It is so terrifying that Sasha screams. But the May Day demonstrators are all safely below, and she is the only one trapped in the center of the storm. The poles of the slogan on her left are rattling by her ear. The sticks with portraits aim at her head from the right. Flags shake with crimson furor and hiss like flames, as if someone has plucked her by the skin of her neck and is about to toss her into the gut of a wood-burning stove. The roar peals over the square like thunder, the mouths fusing into one howling throat, one hungry set of jaws with rows of sticks for teeth, ready to crunch and chew and spit her out.
Wow. Now, did you attend? It sounds like you've attended one of those May Day parades, because that was very visual and very present.
I did attend one of those parades. Stalin was not alive. Stalin died in 1953. So when I was growing up, we went to these parades. They weren't as militarized, so to speak, as they were then. But this one is what my sister told me. She attended one in 1950 in Red Square, and this is the memory that she told me, the memory that I described in this passage.
You know, Russia's got this amazing history of literary figures like Tolstoy and Dostoevsky and Pushkin and Nabokov and Chekhov. Did you read them? Did they inspire you? Is that part of what made you want to become a writer? I mean, you wanted to learn English and write in English, but were you moved or motivated by their stories at all?
Yes, of course. We studied all these writers in school, in secondary school. Not all. I shouldn't say all. Nabokov, God forbid. Nabokov left Russia, and Nabokov was a forbidden figure, writer, forbidden name until Gorbachev's perestroika, until the late 1980s. Gorbachev allowed many banned books, previously banned books, to be published in Russia. So, but Chekhov and Pushkin and Lermontov we studied them in elementary school because they wrote stories for children. Chekhov wrote stories for children. Pushkin wrote fairy tales. We studied them in grades 1, 2, 3, and 4. And then later we studied Dostoevsky. Crime and Punishment was part of the curriculum in 9th grade. And of course, stories by Tolstoy and Turgenev. Later, Chekhov stories for adults, the stories that we know in this country, and Chekhov wrote plenty of those. We studied those. We studied Chekhov's plays. The literature curriculum was very rich, and maybe that is what pushed many of us, many of my friends also, to try to write. But at the time, I didn't. When I was in secondary school, when I was a teenager or a young person in Russia, I didn't think everyone was writing. Everyone around me tried to write. We all tried to write poems. And, you know, when we were teenagers, romantic poems about love, lyrical poems. So it was normal. It was normal to try to write something. And we were encouraged to do that in school. Everyone did that, not just me. So yes, to answer your question, the literature curriculum, I think, formed us and made us rounded individuals in literature. We may not have learned much of real history because our history was always confined to the communist vision, but we certainly learned a lot about Russian literature.
What is your next novel? You already have one in mind, I know. So what comes next?
It is still a work in progress. And I really can't talk about it because it hasn't coalesced yet. But I know it's also happening. It's set in Russia. It's set at a later time, at the time of pre-Gorbachev time, the time in the 1970s, particularly
Brezhnev,
the time of stagnation. That's what it was called, the time of stagnation, when you wouldn't be imprisoned for a joke, as people were during Stalin times, but it was still a very much totalitarian time when the Iron Curtain was clamped down firmly, when people could not leave the country to go abroad, even to visit with a tour, when all the information was controlled and we couldn't get access to contemporary American or British or any kind of capitalist, they were called, magazines or books. We were isolated from the rest of the world. And that is the time when this novel is set. And it is about banned books, the books that were banned in Soviet Russia and that became unbanned, available in the late 1980s.
Now, are you writing now? Do you write to try to flesh an idea out, or is it more just you contemplate an idea and it germinates in your own mind, or do you write that idea into being, kind of developing the concept, then start writing in earnest the actual book?
I think it's both. I don't have one single strategy of writing. It is because writing is so multifaceted and it involves so much that the idea needs to germinate. It needs to percolate, and in the beginning you may not understand some things, and then when I start writing. And let's say I write a certain scene or a certain character becomes more clear, then a certain understanding comes in also. And that's when things can change, even from something that I planned before, and I thought that the plot would go in that direction, and then something happens in the scene, and you realize that, no, it has to go elsewhere. It's a very, it's a process that is difficult to describe. And you know, of course, that the famous, I think it was the famous quote by Doctorov, who said, "When I write, I see, it's like driving at night with your headlights on, and the only thing you see is what is in your headlights."
Yes. Yeah. So exactly.
That was the process for him, but not for everyone. There are other writers who see the whole thing and who plot it and who know what's going to happen. For example, Joyce Carol Oates said, "I attended one of her lectures, and she said, I know where things are going to go. I know what's going to happen. I know where I will end up, but I don't know. What I don't know is how I will get there." So, for example, if I go from New York to California, am I going to go to fly to Canada first and then fly to California? Or am I going to go through the southern part of the country? Or am I going to stop somewhere else? This is what, for her, this is how the process works. So I don't really know. It is very much, it is an exercise in ambiguity, really. It's the tolerance. You really have to have a great deal of tolerance to ambiguity, I think, with writing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So with the train to Moscow, did you know the destination and you wrote towards that destination? Or was it more the E.L. Doctorow method not method of writing, because I don't think it's a conscious choice on your part, but you could see so far ahead and that's what you went to, and then you could see farther ahead as you got to that.
Yeah, I think it was the latter. It was the latter. It was the Doctorow of more than knowing in advance. Because what happened in the scenes that I wrote in her childhood, and then when Sasha becomes an actress in Leningrad, that triggered certain things that had to happen after that.
Elena, I want to wish you luck on A Train to Moscow. I hope it sells a million copies. and I hope your new one is just as big a smash. I hope it takes formation quickly and surely for you. I really appreciate taking the time to come on the program. And, we are, again, all the best to your people in Ukraine and in Russia during this difficult time. I know it's got to be occupying your mind a lot.
Yes.
Thank you again for taking the time. Any last thing you want to say to the listeners?
Well, thank you for inviting me. Thank you for giving me a chance to speak about my work and to speak about my friends in Ukraine and Russia. And it's been a pleasure. Thank you for your insightful questions.